Welcome to the Jack Straw Writers Program, a series of live readings and conversations with Pacific Northwest writers, recorded during the spring of 2005 at Jack Straw Productions in Seattle. This year's series was curated and hosted by John Mifsud. In this program, we will hear from playwright Laurel Ann White and poet Jean Morel. Here's your host, John Mifsud.
Our next reader is a playwright, Laurel Ann White. Ms. White finds her greatest comfort in the written word through giving back by giving voice to the silenced and unheard. Please help me welcome Laurel Ann White.
Hi, I am absolutely amazed and really honored to be here. When the Green River Task Force made their final arrest and the photos of all of the identified women were splashed all over the newspapers, my heart, like thousands of others, probably most of yours, was breaking. And to the general public, thanks to what I consider perfunctory categorical reporting, these women ended up kind of a random wash of something like junkies and whores, demeaned, and also cast aside in favor of the more fascinating killer. Violence doesn't care who we are or what we do or that we all were once little girls barefoot in the grass. I am a grateful survivor of violent crime. And as a woman who has lived to tell her story, I was compelled to write something, anything that might give their voices back to these women. The play is dedicated to the real women of Green River and of Ciudad Juarez and all the other horrific tragedies like them. And it is also dedicated to my niece, Rachel, who was blessed to have gotten out of that car. Stage lights dim. During the following, Martha's face and shoulders are in light that shifts according to her words. We see flashes of streetlights, red flashing stoplights, shadows of rain, like on a windshield spattering and running down her face and shoulders. The minute I got into the car, I had a feeling like I should have, had my hand on the handle, the inside of the door, and I yanked it closed, and just as it latched, crunch, click, a lock clicked, I had this knot, like a knot of vomit just shot up hot in my throat, sour. And I looked back, and I could see the bus stop slipping away, getting small in the rain, and the quick stop, just this bright white square of light, the flashing red sign on that tall, tall pole, all shrinking away, all ripply through the rain coming down the glass. A plastic bag kicked up by the wind. I saw how it flew, hit the window like that and gone, just a blue spot in the night. The radio was on, and There was a chicken, an actor playing like he was a chicken, about being fresh, being Washington grown, and then a woman, chatty, talking about the I-90 traffic, 405, the S-curves, you know, how it was slick from the new rain, and everyone should take care of driving home tonight, maybe take alternate routes. He was laughing about that, or maybe about the chicken, and then he switched to some music. And, you know, he was nice. I mean, he was so nice with the radio on, and he was talking about the Huskies and the first big game coming up, and wasn't it chilly for still being summer, he said, and he pretended to shiver, and then he laughed like he was laughing at himself, and, you know, he was so relaxed, you know, so I relaxed. We must have stopped at 10, 15 lights, stop signs. And I was relaxed, okay. I didn't think of jumping out, and I could have. I mean, I thought it was okay, after all, that he was okay. I was relaxed. And then he took that turn. He took that turn, and I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything because in the movies, they always say, the woman always says, "What are you doing? Where are we going?" And then she gets it. So I didn't say anything. So I wouldn't be like the woman in the movie. And he just hummed and drove, windshield wipers, swish, swish, swish. And then he didn't look at me. Then he asked me if I wanted some. Didn't I want some of his stuff? His thing, he said. I thought, oh no. Then, okay, he's just a perv, and he thinks I'm a prostitute. So I said, laughing, kind of, hey, I'm not into that, if that's what you thought, I said. I've got a job. And he looked at me sideways, still driving, and he smiled real sweet. Real sweet. And I was all at once real cold, I remember, staring at that smile, that face. Cold. And then I looked out, and I didn't know where we were. I couldn't see. It was dark, and he'd turned off the car lights, the headlights. There wasn't any light. There wasn't any light at all anywhere. And I looked at his face, and he was still smiling like that. And I smiled, too. And I slipped my hand to the door handle, and I yanked it back, and it didn't open. And it didn't open. I grabbed with both hands, and I threw myself against the door, and the car, bang, stopped, and he was on me, and he grabbed my hair, yanked my head back, and shoved me down into the seat, my face shoved into the plastic stink of the seat, and he was tearing at my coat, he was tearing at me, he was on me, he was on top of me, his knee was in my stomach and ripping at my coat, and I was banging at the door, kicking all over and pounding, I kicked at the roof, grabbed at his hair, clawed at his ears, ripped hard, loose hair in my face. He screamed and smashed his hand in my mouth, and this hot fire pain just blew up in my face. And then he stopped. He stopped. He closed his eyes and he moved away from me, really careful. He got off me and he sat up very straight in the seat, very straight, wrapped his fingers around the steering wheel tight. And he just sat there, breathing, staring straight ahead, breathing like a meditation, breathing. He stretched his fingers, he curled them, he stretched them, blowing out, breathing in, blowing out, breathing in. I thought, okay, be calm now, just be real nice, real sweet. It's a misunderstanding, it's just a mistake. So I sat up too, and I pulled my coat up close, and I touched at my hair, and I made a smile, just a little smile, kind of like this, biting my lip. And I said, I guess you thought something else. I'm sorry, I'm not into that. That's not what I do. I have a job. I clean houses, and, I can see why you might have thought that, though, being out there like that, but you know, it's really late. I really need to get to work. So if you just open the door and then I'll walk, really. I mean, it's not raining much now. It's pretty clear. And he blew out and in and out and in, and his fingers sprayed out and curled under and sprayed out and curled under. And I had my hand on the handle, but it still wouldn't move, and my other hand digs down into my pocket. There's my rosary, my grandma's rosary. The beads cut glass, and I'm clenching them so tight they cut my hand. And he stops breathing like that. He sits back, his fingers open, then drum, pit pat on the steering wheel. Just stares straight ahead. His mouth open, he licks his lips, and he swallows real deep, and he says, we can do this easy, or we can do this hard. You decide. What? I mean, I don't get it. I say, what? And he says it the exact same way. We can do this easy, or we can do this hard. You decide. And that's when I know. The way he looks at me, how his eyes don't see. Blind, black, glass. His skin, eyes, hair, teeth, all of him gray, flat, blank as paper. Still, like ice. No blinks or breath or sign of life or heat or heart. Just hate. Hate Hate so big and flat and dead. And I know, that's when I know. I know I'm not going to get out of that car. I knew I was never going to get out of that car. Thank you.
Laurel M. White, reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. Our program continues with Jean Morel. Once again, John Mifsud.
Our next reader is Jean Morel. She lives in Seattle and teaches writing at Bellevue Community College. Jean is also working on a series of essays and stories that reflect her experience working with prisoners in the United States. Please help me give a warm welcome to Jean Morel.
Hi. I'm going to read from a collection titled Big Guns, Big Elephants. And this work comes from my experience traveling, working, and living in Southeast Asia, particularly Cambodia. I first traveled to Southeast Asia almost 20 years ago, and it was 10 years ago today, or yesterday, depending how you figure the time change, that I moved to Cambodia, where I lived for a couple of years. So these poems are glimpses from that life, and I hope that they offer glimpses into the very texture of the physical place, the written word, the projections of travelers, the jargon of academia, and perhaps most importantly, the complexities and contradictions of being attached to a country other than one's own. The first poem is called A Metaphorical Offering, and in it there are references to temples and cages and birds. And outside Buddhist temples in Southeast Asia, it's very common to see children carrying small cages with birds in them. And people go to the temple, particularly on auspicious occasions, and buy the birds and release them as a way to make merit. And the children run around and re-catch the birds, and the process continues. So the first poem is an allusion to that practice. A metaphorical offering, or Kafka's cage in search of a bird. Outside the temple, the sun was bright and hot. The fortune teller was sitting on a mat beneath the trees. A mangy dog lay in the dust. Three small boys were running circles in the courtyard, swinging the bars of empty cages wide against the sun. Beyond the village, the soldiers ate their lunch in silence. It was too hot for idle talk. In the city, politicians rested from the sun and feared the worst. Later that afternoon, thousands of people walked to the temple to pray to the gods, to celebrate their birthdays, to release the birds. But the birds were gone, the cages empty, a good deed undone. My first trip to Southeast Asia was in the 1980s, and at that time it wasn't possible to go to Cambodia, but it was possible to go to the refugee camps on the Thai-Cambodia border. And so my friends and I arrived at the Thai town of Aranyaprotet, which is close to the border, and we had very limited Thai and an even more limited idea of what was going on and what we were doing and how we should get out to the border. So this poem is a reflection of that trip. Cestina-like musings. It was mid-afternoon when we got a driver to take us to the border. The way had been mapped out back in the late 80s. Back in America, in rooms with cubicles, government forms, social service interviews. The hotel at Aranyaprotet had not yet been checked into. The review of the political situation not yet understood. The review of all that and more would come later. For now, we were young girls on our way to the border. Thailand, the 80s, the Eagles, Hotel California. We forgot the map. We forgot about stopping. We forgot Task Force 80 and the interview. From the truck, we saw children running. Okay, okay, America, America, number one. Thumbs up, round faces smiling. Okay, okay, smiling. What a review. When interviewed, the faux expert said, when we got to the border, the children were smiling. All books on Cambodia begin with the map. Like the hotel, check out any time, but keep the map. Welcome to the Hotel California. What a lovely place. We are all just Americans, after all. Despite the anomaly, the space of this map is meaningful and can be imagined. Imagine reviews on the nightly news. Unlike the French envoys and cartographers, our border was drawn long before the interview began. The first time I went to Phnom Penh was in 1993, during the time the United Nations had temporarily taken over the country. And it was a time of enormous change when Cambodia was coming out of 20 years of isolation and suddenly finding itself to be the last front of the Cold War. And the world was briefly converging there to hold an election. And this poem is an observation from that time. Post office. Colonial building closed for years. The post office is now open. Most governments get the mail out. Most. Amid open spaces, tall shadows, the building stirs. At work, among stacks of paper, wooden tables, a dark-skinned woman, white blouse, long sleeves, sits silently and stamps packets bound for other planets. In the river, fishermen cast nets in muddy water. The woman sits and watches, dreams local gossip, petty government officials, soap operas, karaoke, movie stars. Outside, the city moves. Bicycles, motos, small white Toyotas. Big guns, big elephants have come to town. They stomp the dust up in the hot sun and move on. The next poem is a meditation on self and the search for the place that poems come from and the mystery of why we're drawn to certain places. Postcards. First journey past the border. The poems are postcards from the past. She remembers friends, language, other eras yet familiar. Still photos. Reflections fall in order. Her center of gravity lower than usual. A magnetic pull pulls her, tugs her toward the center. Another look back, postcards to the past. Bright sun, flame trees, orange blossoms, green vivid leaves. Cumulus cloud towers, white blue sky. The poems are square and flat and fit visually and easily into the message portion on the back of the card. Plenty of room left for the address and stamps. At the intersection of Norodom and Pochentong, the boulevard is empty, yet is slowly moving. No chatter fills the cards. They are not written poolside, nor from the hotel by the river. The motos are old, the cyclos slow. Messages coming for a long time. They circle Wat Phnom and go another round. And the last poem I'm going to read tonight is a collage of the personal and the political, and I leave it open to your interpretation. Catastrophe. And so he rushed out to transform the country, thoroughly and at once. The women were just leaning against the writing desk in the next room. Communist cadres ordered everyone out of the cities and towns. They had not allowed themselves much of a rest and were already coming. The explorer, on the other hand, felt greatly troubled. The dominance of the countryside over the cities and the privileged position of the poor. He really did not know what to rescue first. Everything I am about to argue here could be taken as local and personal. The decision to evacuate was made and four times changed direction. Yet I have no difficulty in stating the central premise of my argument. The machine was obviously going to pieces. Its silent working was a delusion rooted in one country and one poetic inheritance. Please accept, Excellency, my dear friend, my faithful and friendly sentiments. One can never find out exactly what is happening, or only a long time afterwards. The revolutionary period was characterized by regional and temporal variations. Cadences and metaphors are particular and peculiar. Take the jar from me, return it to its cupboard at arm's length, and move into an imaginative world. You leave, and it is my wish that you and your country will find happiness under the sky. I'm sure you have nothing against my dancing. Thank you very sincerely for your letter and for your offer to transport me toward freedom. We have a saying here, perhaps you've heard it. Official decisions are as shy as young girls. Still, this baby must not know. We will remember meeting the past, black with red fire. Thank you.
Jean Morel, reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. These readings and interviews were recorded at Jack Straw Productions during the spring of 2005 as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program and co-produced for radio with 94.9 KUOW Seattle. The curator of this year's program was John Mifsud. Audio engineer and producer for radio was Scott Bartlett. The program's manager was Steve Peters. The executive director of Jack Straw Productions is Joan Rabinowitz. The Jack Straw Writers Program is made possible with support from the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation for the Arts, the Brenham and Jake Foundation, Arts Fund, the Mayor's Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs, the For Culture King County Lodging Tax Fund, the Washington State Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, Humanities Washington, and individual contributors. Support for radio production provided by Clark Neuber, Certified Public Accountants and Consultants. Original music provided by Jack Straw Artist-in-Residence, Ela Lamlin. All of the writers heard in this series are published in Volume 9 of the Jack Straw Writers Anthology and featured online in the Jack Straw Writers Forum at jackstraw.org. To purchase a copy of the anthology or for more information about Jack Straw Productions or the Jack Straw Writers Program, please contact us by phone at 206-634-0919. Or visit us at www.jackstraw.org. Thanks for listening.